Hello and welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. You can contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. So beautiful spring day outside, and that's helping us move quickly on from the wintry gloom of a Six Nations that failed to inspire. Happily, though, some sanity seems to have returned to the coverage of the now-departed tournament, with most people accepting that maybe we celebrated a little too well and not too wisely on the back of the Slam and New Zealand game, and maybe, therefore, we shouldn't drink too deep from the whatever of despair just because we were beaten by decent English and Welsh sides. And that's probably where we leave the sense and sensibility and go off-road for the next half an hour or so. Against the head producer, Wes Liddy is here as ever, and ex-Irish number 9 Steve McIver, now with a PhD in his quiver, Dr. Steve McIver, talks about managing the top 2 inches. We'll also have a chat with Ali Donnelly a little bit later about the situation in the women's game in Ireland. First, though, the headlines are read for you by Michael Glennon.
That's a great introduction. So if we just have a look, would you believe it, just as you're saying goodbye to the 2019 Six Nations, the fixtures for the next 2 years are out,
and
it's actually
it, yeah.
One of the most popular stories on the site, so I don't even want to go into it.
Tell us who we have, because
okay,
so I haven't heard.
Actually, it'll be interesting for the fact it'll be Andy Farrell's first game in charge, and
God,
we start at home to Scotland and home to Wales.
Two home games
to kick us off.
Okay.
I think it's the middle game with the 2 week break either side is England. So,
right,
whatever way that will work out, they'll probably be happy enough with that. Italy, and final game is against France, which is that will be the last game of the tournament. And I was just reading there that it could play out that the winner of the tournament might not be known until 10 o'clock because it's a late kickoff.
Okay, well, that's sure. We have an old World Cup to get through before
it's still a popular story.
Treadmill, really, isn't it, being involved in sport?
Also then, Johnny Holland has his column this morning, and I know Wes will elaborate on that in a few moments.
Yeah, he made an interesting point about young Sean French, the fact that he had a couple of games for Conn during the 20s championship and it did him no harm whatsoever. It's a nice little case study for those that say the players shouldn't be wrapped in cotton wool. I thought, good point, Johnny.
Absolutely. Then we had the story yesterday about Spygate, or was alluding to a new book coming out where...
Dirty Tricks.
Dirty Tricks. So the IRFU were so worried about a report about a meeting they had to discuss the 2007 World Cup failings that was leaked to the newspapers, that they hired in an ex-British military intelligence officer to sort it out, and he appeared to gain all sorts of access.
It's good for IRFU, that story.
Just to say, the IRFU say his account is fictionalised.
Yeah, or where else will we go with... did you go down to the aftermath of the last kind of Six Nations press gathering?
Absolutely, yes. So the IRFU agreed to do their press conference first and let Wales have their celebration. So Joe and Rory came out, did their 15 minutes, and then a lot of journalists stayed up for the Warren Gatland and Jones press conference, and myself and another couple of guys went down, and we were speaking to Dave Kilcoyne, Rob Carney and Tyke Byrne were down there as well. They wanted to come in and get their job done and head off. I thought maybe Conor Murray or Johnny Sexton could have come down. I know there's a rotation system in place, but maybe they could have been able to elaborate a bit more on the performances.
But they do kind of slag each other, but probably not in good humoured fashion after a loss like that. But whoever draws the short straw, it's regarded as the short straw, mm-hmm. Whoever has to go down and face us grubby hacks, isn't it?
I hope we're all looking forward to it.
No, they love you. They love you.
We'll just play a clip now from Rob Carney.
There's a lot of mini huddles out there during the course of the game. Was it frustrating to have so many leaders on the field and didn't seem to be able to stem some of the faults during the game?
No, I don't think so. A lot of the faults were, discipline and handling errors that were in our own control. You don't necessarily need to look to your leaders to find solutions to that. I think with those things in particular, they're just individual responsibilities. Conditions made it pretty tough in terms of our handling.
Did you want to play with the roof open?
That didn't really bother me too much, to be honest. You know, it was a collective decision made by coaches and leaders of the team throughout the week. And, you know, we can't go looking for excuses now.
I got a ban talk of the roof, okay, it's all over. But the mini huddle question, what were you hoping to get out of that, Michael? Were you hoping Rob would turn around and say, do you know what, we all hate each other's guts, and it was really obvious during the game? Because he's got a bat that one, isn't he?
No, it was just more that, say, after the All Blacks match, we talked about the leaders and how they performed on the pitch. So they were given the praise they deserved after that. And sometimes you hear about a lack of leadership, but if you just look across the line between Rory Best, Peter O'Mahony, Sean O'Brien, Murray Sexton and Kearney, and it was a feature of the earlier games that things were going wrong, and it was a question, why didn't the leader stand up, have a word with the young lads, why were they forcing the game so early, stuff like that.
Let's ask the man next year. Welcome to the RT Rugby Podcast, Steve, and thanks for coming.
Thank you very much,
Dr. Steve.
Great to see you again after so few years. I find that fascinating. I find, you know, we look at the surface of what Rob said, and Rob is very aware and very smart, and he's going to give a very smart political endorsing and supportive answer about the players. But even, you know, talking to my students this morning, and we look at leadership, that ill-defined and misunderstood quality. Sometimes leadership is not driving. It's almost taking that pressure away. And when he said about, well, there's individual errors, there's individual control issues, you know, how do we reduce that stress that reduces the amount of errors? I mean, the awareness of the leaders saying, are we adding pressure to the team now, or are we pulling pressure away by what we're saying? And we look at the cliche classics comments of, let's just calm down, lads. We're good rugby players. We know what we're doing. Recognise that we're carrying too much stress to be able to perform the skills, which are leading to the breakdown of the skills. And then recognise the messages those leaders send then creates the emotional contagion within the team. If we don't recognise that we're carrying too much stress and release that stress, then we're not going to lead in an appropriate way.
Interesting. And I've no idea, but I'm curious. So in a way, not mentioning stress is a creator of stress.
Absolutely.
Not saying,
absolutely,
look, lads, we're stressed out, will you?
Totally.
If England had done that at 31-0 up, I would assume that they would have got their act together before Scotland put 38 on them.
Well, if we look at England, in fact, actually stress was the problem for them in terms of they let the stress go. They slipped from being very focused. They came out, regardless of not winning the championship after seeing Wales winning, they came out with a ferocity and an intensity. Yes, we can argue that Scotland were not equipped, weren't capable, weren't able at that moment in time. But England came out and destroyed them. What seeped into certain players within that team, even Owen Farrell, who I would have incredible respect for, just became a little bit lazy in his kicking. That caused the block down. Johnny May had the pace to catch your man for that try. Did he make the tackle stick? Why did the percentage of that intensity with the tackle reduce? Was an element of complacency. So we always recognise players...
There's two sides of it then. So the stress gauge needs to be upped sometimes and needs to be brought down other times.
We talk about the optimum level of stress, whether we buy into the eyes-off individual zone of functioning, whether you look at the inverted U. We know at the very highest... At the very highest level of performance, we're going to be uncomfortable. We're going to feel that stress and that pressure, which incredibly, in fairness to Ireland, they really apply very well, the attention to detail, the controllable factors. But we've also got to assess that, are we putting too much pressure on ourselves? Are we slipping into the outcome rather than the process and the controllable factors? And yeah, England absolutely demonstrated the other side of that inverted U, where, you know what, we're 31-0 up, we're the dogs, we're the men, it's going to be okay. And all of a sudden we know in terms of psychological momentum is talked about but doesn't exist unless we believe psychological momentum exists. And that way then all of a sudden England gets more fractious. They get more worried that they couldn't come back 2 tries, 3 tries. And all of a sudden that lack of, as Wes said, about playing process, we drift into the outcome. England drifted into the outcome on a positive.
Wes, you said that in the canteen, so remind everyone.
Jesus, where to start with all that? Yeah, I suppose the process side of it from Ireland's point of view, I suppose, like, you know, I don't have the qualifications in psychology that Steve has, but I mean...
Don't dumb yourself
but
down.
But then again, Wes, you learned rugby in Limerick, the same place I did, so we've got a good basis.
But I think in anything in life, the antidote for stress or rumination or worries is always to ground yourself in the now. to focus on a task stops you fretting about another task. So in that way, the process-driven approach to sport, of course, it stops you stressing about outcomes because your focus is on, you know, the 6 inches in front of your face. So it could be perfectly valid that when you start to be motivated by worry about the outcome, mm-hmm. which is probably different than hope about the outcome mm-hmm. in terms of chasing a win versus worrying about losing, that starts to distract from the detail in that minutia that's been a trademark of this team. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense. And I think with England particularly, you know, Murray Mixted has that famous phrase, the ebb and flow of psychic energy, which a journalist in this country has made his own.
Well, I always use that one when it comes to hurling.
But it's completely true. And you see, complacency might have been the root of it becoming 28-7 or 28-14. But then the worry of losing is actually magnified because you're coming from a position where there's no possible justification for losing.
The moment has changed.
No, but it's much worse, the thought of losing having been 28-7 up, than the thought of losing when you were starting at 0-0.
So
that fear of failure is magnified again.
It almost becomes preordained that you're going to be part of a great disaster.
And you're just fighting this whole chain of events then at that point, and it just becomes this groundswell of noise, I guess.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then we get more anxious, then we make more mistakes, and then we convince ourselves, you know what, the prophecy of us now losing this match is coming to pass. Mm. So we create those self-fulfilling prophecies.
So how do you ground yourself in the moment in the middle of a high-pressure environment then?
Well, what we need there is, in terms of what Rob Kearney said, is actually the leadership to recognise we're getting overheightened.
Do you think the grounding really should happen, ideally does happen, before the match?
Well,
that you're in a mindset approaching the whistle and that's it.
Ideally, absolutely. It's far harder for us to adjust in the middle of a battle than prepare. And in fairness to Ireland's preparation, has been excellent in so many levels and so many areas. But did this Six Nations, and I saw Eddie O'Sullivan talking on Against the Head, and we're talking about in a tournament, you feel like you're on a train you can't get off. And that's really hard to change the mindset. And I know the players talked about having a social event, but did they really buy into that social event and actually de-stress and relax? Or were they just ticking a box that didn't then answer the questions?
If you look at, like, team that always fascinates me above any other is Kilkenny in their absolute pomp under Cody in 2008 when they won an All-Ireland final by 30 points, 3 in a row, blah, blah, blah. Like, I've been lucky enough to get to know a lot of the guys that were on that team through work. And, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but there's always this thing of, we didn't look at the scoreboard at any point. Mm-hmm. We were playing the same regardless of the minute or situation in that game, and we applied that to training and we applied it to everything else. And if you look across kind of epochal teams that we've seen in recent times across a whole spectrum of sport, teams that would be ranked in that all-time great category. For me, off the top of my head, you'd have Barcelona a few years back. You'd have the All Blacks of around 2011. You'd have the New England Patriots. You'd have Kilkenny. And they cross, you know, some of them are amateurs, some of them are multimillionaires, some of them are pros, some of them are on one side of the world, some are on the other. Like, they're completely different. But if you track through, be it academic research that's been mm-hmm. done on them, or through rare lapses in the media of offering a window into their soul, so mm-hmm. to speak, mm-hmm. they all adhere to the same things. They all have similar diktats that are quoted and paraphrased ad nauseum that are very different because of the
nature of their games.
Well, and the cultural
background,
environment
they
operate in.
Yeah.
Like Bill Belichick comes out and says, do your job. You know, in the New England Patriots, it sounds Yankee and capitalist.
And that
but there's not much difference
to
when Brian Cody says, I'm not worried about continuity and selection. I'm worried about continuity and spirit.
Yeah.
You know,
he's tapping into the same things.
But because Brian Cody says it in an Irish rural accent, it's deemed as, he's not saying anything, sure. It's the same old stuff. Yeah. You're going, no, he's actually saying everything.
Something profound.
If you're listening.
Yeah.
You know, so it's funny how they...
But that's
they all adhere to these same principles.
Mm-hmm. And those constant messages, Wes, are conditioning the younger players coming in through the older players, through the coach, to naturally attend to that process. So either by accident or by intention, they're reducing the propensity, the attention dealt with that outcome and back onto the pressure to perform. which is the
tools
subtlety.
For dismantling the tension that you were suggesting there, that there was almost a forced element to the jollity. We don't know, but that the Irish lads were go out and have a few beers and have the crack.
Well, I think Wes sort of alluded to it earlier on in terms of grounding before the matches, in terms of grounding, in terms of, well, you know, we talked outside, even that these players are at the highest level, they can't consider themselves just purely as a rugby player. It's not advantageous to them to be able to perform. If we put all our eggs, the cliche, into one basket, and all of a sudden that basket is attached to an outcome, then we're putting so much uncontrollable factors into our performance. Any person is going to find that hard to struggle with. So it's about grounding the people in who they are. It's humour is a fantastic conduit to that. But gaining perspective, I know certain teams, very successful Southern Hemisphere teams and Northern Hemisphere teams, and in fact the GAA do it retrospectively, the games, they'll go and visit hospitals. Mm. They'll bring players that are under stress or under pressure to a hospice, a hospital. And why are they getting such more pressure situations? Because it's putting perspective on them.
Sure.
They're going out and able to play rugby. Yeah. They're going out and play some. I mean, that's...
Yeah, you're waking up in the morning a fit young man. Remember
absolutely.
This. Yeah.
That grounds us and allows us to focus better.
There's a famous article in academic circles that you'll know, written by a guy from the University of Otago, Ken Hodge, is it?
Ken Hodge,
so it's called Creating a Motivational Climate in a World Championship.
You showed it to me once.
And it's about the All Blacks. It's very good because it's like Steve might probably pick a lot of holes in it in an academic sense, but it's very accessible outside academia,
absolutely.
Is why it's easy to read. But it's based on interviews with Wayne Smith, Graham Henry, and a bunch of All Blacks. Throughout
what period
that,
are we talking about?
Probably post the failure in 03,
building towards 11. And also post 07. It was the transition where they went into a collaborative dual management process was one of the processes that came out.
You know, they all swapped roles. The forwards coach became the backs coach. But
and they decided not to dump Henry.
Yeah, but it was, I suppose the crux of it was this whole identity that we've all become familiar with through a few media soundbites the last few years, this better people make better All Blacks, all this stuff. It was identifying these key drivers of the group. And one of the 12 things identified, which several of them harked on even unwittingly, was one of their base drivers was love. And you read it and you go, okay.
Sure.
But it was brought out into a load of different things. Mm-hmm. It was love for the game, which they meant to see as because they're one of the few countries in the world where rugby is their national sport and where it's so intrinsic to their way of life that they have a feeling for the game beyond other countries. And then they brought that out to love for teammates, for family, playing for something. And
it's just the positive side to their humanity, isn't it?
It's identity. It's identity as well.
Well, identity
can be a positive.
Defining
what they are, and that's what Steve was kind of hitting on a minute ago.
And there's a quote in that research article about love and about friendship, and I can't think it bring it to mind. But absolutely, what Wes
Mike
says,
is on his phone there.
One of the captains of a World Cup winning team in my own research said, if I'm going to run into a small car crash, i.e. a tackle, then I've got to know the person beside me is connected to me and that I'm connected to him. Mm-hmm. And he would say, we don't have to know each other's personal history, but I want to know his girlfriend's name, where they go for lunch every so often. So those connections, and as Wes said, that social identity theory, that tribalism that human society works on, really galvanizes a team, and especially under pressure.
So do the Irish team, keep going, but just somebody said the other day about the Irish team, they do room in pairs still, don't they? Because there was some question mark about...
God, that's interesting. We always did back in the day. I'd be surprised if they didn't, that would be a loss.
I think the context of this was someone who I won't say, because he might have just said it was pub talk, that like he was, when they were discussing accommodation arrangements for a big tournament, they were each given single rooms, and he said no good to him.
But if you go back to those teams I mentioned a minute ago, right? It's always comes out in the papers, the Patriot way, right? Even though they're a professional organisation where the players change every year, there's a way of doing things. La Masia in Barcelona with grooming players from a very young age. Better people make better All Blacks.
Sure.
Brian Cody with spirits not to be broken.
Barcelona more than a club.
They cultivate the idea that you're playing for an entity.
Something bigger than yourself,
But not just in a way, not even in a tangible way of, I'm playing for my family. It's like, the way they do their business becomes one and the same as the individual identity. And I wonder how that kind of highly emotional resonance ties in with you got to bend your knees more and hit 16 rocks in the next 8 minutes or whatever the cipher for minute technical detail is in, say, the Irish camp.
Well, I think it goes back to what you said, Wes, in terms of the love factor in that Hodges piece. As we know in any relationship, not that we're going to go down relationship advice here.
Not yet.
But we do need...
I'm hoping we will at some point.
You're very secure, obviously, as you know, with Sky for myself.
We're quite happy where we are. But we need to obviously constantly work on those relationships and keep us grounded and keep us connected to each other. And talking those stressors out, as you said, Dara, to recognise stress is part of the thing we're carrying. How do we manage it? How do we deal with it? How do we let it go? And as you said, Wes, earlier on, restructure that into something that we can control and what we can commit. And feeling that collectiveness reduces anxiety automatically. Mm-hmm. But if we increase pressures between some of the body language and the message players, what do? We increase isolation. And when we get isolated, we increase stress.
I like the language we're talking here, and there's a spiritual element to it, which I think is grand. I don't feel in any way embarrassed about talking about that. But I suppose the business side of it is blame culture versus accountability. Mm-hmm. And that's always a tightrope, isn't it? Because you can't say there's nobody to blame. But then when does it become just finger pointing, and when does it become that the person within the collective recognises their own accountability? And that is recognised by the teammates, and therefore it gives everyone a lift, because I'm saying, well, the guy next to me is taking responsibility for his errors.
Yeah.
How does that work mid-match?
Well, in mid-match, we need to support that individual and understand that that individual who just dropped the ball didn't intend to drop that ball.
Well, that raises an interesting point now, and one of the key players' protestations at our teammates' errors throughout this tournament.
Yeah.
And, you know, but how appropriate that may be.
What, Johnny Sourpuss?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we got to recognise our experiences create the player that we are in terms of, and we talked earlier on, experiential learning and reflective learning are two of the basis of how we improve our performances. And if we look back, way back to Northampton, Leinster, Heineken Cup final, we all talk about Johnny Sexton making that incredible intervention at halftime where he called senior players, Brian O'Driscoll, Shane Horgan, to task for what they were doing. So he learned from that experience that I can make a serious impact here. And he's consistently done that. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the environment is constantly changing. The social milieu, the psychosocial factors are constantly changing. So a behaviour back then was massively impactful. A behaviour similar to that was important and useful last year. But if the dynamic between the group is changing, or the increases in
that
stress...
That old trick is no use anymore.
Well, then we can actually add fuel to that
fire. Be counterproductive.
And we can be counterproductive.
Psychosocial factors, I want to get back to them, because I just want to learn more about whatever they are. It's such a wonderful phrase.
It is, yeah. Psychosocial factors would
Hang
be the basis...
Sec. Michael, psychosocial factors, you as a layman, what does that mean to you?
Psychosocial factors, is it how you adapt to the environment? How does your brain adapt to the environment you find yourself in?
It how your brain is impacted by the social environment that you're in. And when we look at reciprocal determinism, basically Christ. Dara impacts his environment and then we impact the environment back to him. So he gets back that impact.
Okay.
So how we walk into a room, I remember one of the coaches saying, and it was a very successful again, won a World Cup. He said, how I walked into a room after a loss, and they didn't have an awful lot of losses, would determine the success by a certain amount of percentage for the next match. Because he needed to show that he had
this
solutions.
Is in your research when you were talking to World Cup winners.
So when we're talking about how to build mental
PhD.
Toughness in groups environment, is the body language and the way he walked into the room sets the tone. And that then comes back to give belief to the players. Psychosocial factors is the environment and recognising, Dara, the environment to optimise our interactions, our social milieu, how we work to give us the end product of a happy, and it's often underrated, positive, efficient
So it's a fluid thing, like day to day.
That's the hard thing with psychology. It's constantly fluid, and we've got, as much as Wes, Michael, myself and yourself are the same people, our moods will change and our stressors will increase. And really smart leadership is recognising the changing dynamic and pressing the buttons.
How much of this, Steve, is down to just... down to your birth cert when you were born? Because I know that you couldn't have brought this to bear in the 90s when you were playing for Gary Owen in Ireland. But, you know, how much of it is a kind of an age thing that you've just been longer on the planet and that you can accept maybe that your understanding, instinctive first thought isn't a good one and that you begin to filter it a little, or maybe not filter, but did you adapt your behaviour because you know your behaviour isn't perfect? When you're 20, you kind of think you're perfect, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, and we do. And if we look at that, and that's a tough question, Dara, but if you look at that, what are we all constantly, and not to get too philosophical, we're on this journey of our own awareness as to how do we optimise opportunities, optimise our work, optimise our businesses, optimise our playing performance. And that's adaptability, emotional intelligence, to work in a system with people. The content knowledge is really important in rugby or in any sport or in any
life. Content knowledge is skills, is it?
Content knowledge, your core knowledge of the game. Right. And the likes of Eddie O'Sullivan, Joe Schmidt, Eddie Jones. You know, there's umpteen fantastic coaches with the content knowledge. It's the ability to relate and understand where players are that then allows them
to tweak,
manage, and sometimes I use the term manipulate, but in a positive strain, to get what those players, kids, people want to attain. Because sometimes we give them too much credence that they can make decisions that they don't have the awareness yet.
Stephen, I just wanted to ask, because we're not too far off from the Ireland match that we can analyse it or the campaign itself, but when you were looking at that, it's something that Wes and when Bernard was in here, we were talking about. I was wondering whether Ireland's problems were more technical or mental. And at the time, it was okay, it was just after the England match. We go, okay, there's a few technical things that if they iron them out. But with Ireland having had 5 games, 7 or 8 weeks, and they didn't iron them out, is there more weight in the theory that Ireland's problems are psychological or mental issues that should be addressed, as opposed to going back to training and just training harder, doing the same drills?
That is the common misconception is, you know, if it's not working, train harder. And we know it's about training smarter in terms of psychology. And again, one of the top coaches in my research had an incredible statement. He said some of the best training sessions we did before really serious matches were the ones we cancelled. Were the ones we knew the players weren't in the right place to go out and push things with because they were under that stress.
So Cheka broke out the beers for Leinster there when he came at one stage when they were under pressure, and he just he brought all the guys out to the field and took out the beers. It was like a scene out of Shawshank or something.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's a famous story where Gatland in Wasps, there was a lot of fractious changes and he was introducing. He brought them to training, closed the doors into the bar, and they just had a couple of beers and probably a couple more on beers on top of that. Going back to the question, Michael, in terms of the technical, I would say we look at the actual what happened. Tactically, we could possibly have things done better defensively and maybe some of our plays. Technically, our technical skills don't change. Exponentially, they don't change over a period of time. They take several months. So it's not that. I would definitely say it's psychological, holistic in terms of the environment, and some tactical nuances. Maybe Joe Schmidt is holding these things in reserve.
Well, to introduce a tactical nuance to a team lacking confidence is probably not the right timing.
Absolutely, you're dead
right
there.
Wait until they're hitting their straps again.
Yeah.
Lads, a fable. A wise man once told me, and he said to me, he said, if a zebra is chased by a lion, what does he do the following day? And I said, well, sorry, excuse me. If a zebra is chased by a lion, what does he do? I said, he runs like you know what. He said, yeah, but what does he do the following day? And I was, I don't know, I suppose he just grazes. He goes, exactly, what does a human being do? And I said, talks shite about it for the rest of his life, how he was nearly eaten by a lion. Correct, he said. So we've got to be zebras sometime. You've got to actually go back to just forgetting about the past, don't you?
You do. You've got to let go, but you've got to try and increase some awareness as to where we might have gone wrong. And that takes, I think...
Yeah, but there isn't lions around every corner, is what he's saying. And we as humans tend to over-alarm ourselves, no?
We tend to, and we are predetermined and conditioned to protect ourselves. So we're going to look for threats rather than positives. Mm. And definitely, if we go back to Michael's point on the psychological aspect, maybe we need a rethought and rethink what we do well, what we have done well, what we can do well, trying to lift that stress and pressure and put it back into controllable factors, but definitely recognising we were probably carrying too much tension and too much tension between the group.
And what we do well is hold the ball and make it difficult for the others to get at it and have nice, clean, protected ball, but we weren't doing that well. So all of a sudden you need a different skill set, which is go and chase down a 14, 16, 18 point deficit, which may be not just about kind of going back to the process of the possession game. Now, to stray into rugby for a minute, which I hate to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we look at the Wales match, there was the breakdown of the skills that Rob Kearney alluded to and mentioned. If we hadn't,
I was wondering, was that more decision making? So it's not a skill where if Tadhg Furlong gets a sloppy ball off a line out, he throws a bad ball to Conor Murray, but I think he should never have thrown it in the first place. So he was getting a poor ball, giving a poor ball. There was a knock on. I was just thinking that guys like this would know never to do that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So they're forcing things. You're saying there's a fair chance that he's forcing that pass because there's a stress which is now causing an indecision. So when we have stress, do I go
it's
left or go right?
It's an indecision though, isn't it?
It's an indecision.
When we say decision-making, it's wrong. No. Because any decision-making that happens is so quick that you're not consciously deciding, will I pass this ball or not? It's an instinct.
Exactly.
And your instinct somehow seems to be malleable based on the overall mood of the team.
Totally impacted by the mood of the team. And as you're dead right, a decision is a positive, proactive thing to do. Indecision is not proactive. That's a questioning, that's a stress.
When you say go back to the strengths, and obviously it makes perfect sense to four people sitting around listening to it, I wonder, is there with this team, now I'm sure if I said this to anyone involved with the Irish team, they could give me 50 cases of why I'm wrong. But there seems to the layman looking throughout the history of this particular team that the answer to failure seems to be to do what we're doing, but do it better. So going back to what we're good at, if there is some kind of minor leap in tactics required, isn't necessarily the best approach in this instance.
No, not necessarily.
But to get back in control of that, though, first, surely.
Yeah, but maybe part of the problem is we need an evolution in the tactics.
I think the term that there for me is the key aspect. It's an evolution. When we recognise when we climb a hill, get to the top of the mountain, if we feel we've arrived at the top of the mountain, we start protecting that. And definitely we possibly fell into an inkling, a percentage point of complacency after beating New Zealand, or a more likely protect what we have already achieved and done. Human beings find it hard to grow, we find change difficult, but we're also conditioned that that's where we feel a purpose. Purpose is massively important for us. So by constantly evolving, constantly changing the dynamic, what you're talking about, Wes, it stops us from ruminating, worrying about what we're protecting, and it puts us on a forward momentum. And how do we improve? How do we get better? So it's almost ironic, when we gain success, we can often start protecting ourselves. If we go back to the process that you talked about in Kilkenny and these other teams, it's constant growth, it's constant improvement. How do we get better? And that actually reduces the stress and worries about protecting something we don't have. It's about, how do I show a better attitude? How do I show a greater work rate? How do we tweak this defence, this tactical awareness? And all of a sudden our worries become less, and our positivity about improving becomes greater.
Those lads that you were talking about, the Kilkenny men, I mean, they're all into their at least 30s now. I mean, do you think that they had some sort of gift of serenity to begin with? Or is that the way they've become?
I think in their case, they were, first of all, a freakishly talented generation came together at once. Arguably the greatest player of all time. Two or three guys amongst the greatest ever playing their own position in JJ and Tommy Walsh and others. The culture and the mood within the camp was manipulated brilliantly and ruthlessly by Brian in charge. Now, Brian mightn't have been able to get away with what he got away with another bunch of players. He could with that group. The whole, you know, bear pit training sessions in Nolan Park, the sheer ruthlessness, all that stuff.
Yeah. But there's constant mini transactions that you're getting rewarded in as well, because you feel your improvement, presumably, and
good
then
feedback.
You get the medals to prove your improvement.
Exactly, yeah. But I mean, I suppose also with them, like, it's not to say that there's not psychology in what they're doing. There's obviously psychology in what they're doing all the time, but they are amateur sportsmen from a rural town in Ireland.
Yeah.
And the old guff that goes with the rugby team sometimes just isn't tolerated.
Right.
It's a much more earthy environment.
So our last 40 minutes could be condensed to two.
I'm not complaining about the players with Ireland when I say that, but all the likes of us and the shite we go on with about the Irish rugby team.
To justify
if someone walked up to Brian Cody in the middle of one of those training sessions and started talking to him about, you know, my reciprocal
I'd say
I could predict how he'd respond, you know.
But if we put it in the simple terms, how you say hello to someone's going to impact how they feel. And that's the simplistic way.
Or in his case, a lot of times how he didn't say hello to anyone.
Yeah, and set a tone. But if we look at that,
there's the embattled thing too. Sorry, Steve. Yeah. Like some teams would deliberately, and this is when the media.
Well, not everyone could stand up to that environment. Sure. He was lucky that he had the materials to stand up to it.
Sure.
Maybe it's a different approach is needed for bunch of players in the Irish rugby team.
To build collectivism, you need a kind of an enemy as well, not in the middle of a match, but like, or you need somebody that everybody agrees they dislike. Unfortunately, human beings being human beings, they can't just the love can't give them enough. They need a bit of hate as well.
But, yeah, but, well, I mean, his famous one was, what was it that he said about, you know, when you hear these old Ramesh speeches about, I'm willing to, you know, I'll die for this team. Yeah. And his response was always, you shouldn't want to die for it, but you should be willing to kill for it.
There you go.
You know? Yeah. And they certainly very played like they were willing to do that.
Yeah.
But am I right? Like, he did that day to day. Brian Cody was a teacher.
Yeah.
And so was Declan Kidney, and so was Eddie O'Sullivan, and so was Graham Henry. And that combative...
Joe Schmidt.
And Joe Schmidt, managing that environment, and we think, oh, they're only kids. That's a combative environment, to be able to manage that group. And I think, again, it goes back to the intelligence, whether we look at, you know, Kilkenny or we look at any of these things, the ability to manage people. Leadership is that.
Fascinating this week. Alison Donnelly's on the line. We'll bring Ali in a second. But Noel McNamara said that the 20s, who gave us all a thrill, like they had the right to make mistakes, or if that wasn't the exact phrase, Noel, apologies. I know you're on holidays this week. But he also said that he had to stick, that they went back and stuck to the processes. So you got both sides there, which was one, be free to express yourself and don't judge yourself. And on the other hand, but don't forget that you have been given these skills and they will kick in if your mindset is right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's your, is that your balance? Your,
well, I think the point that you made there, Dara, about don't judge yourself is a crucial component. If we look at the holistic environment we're changing, people are conditioned to unfortunately judge themselves more and more on a daily basis.
Why is that? Everything. Social media?
Well, social media is definitely adding.
It's
are
a bit glib, but it is.
Yeah,
part
it is
of
a
it.
Bit glib, but we are conditioned to compare ourselves to other people. If we look at a fantastic video of an incredible coach, John Wooden, he says success is not in comparison, and that's a real truism that we're forgetting. But now we're adding a petrol bomb on top of that, that we're constantly being compared, and that means we're judging ourselves, and that message by the 20s coach is fantastic by Noel. I mean, it's a really good message, and that de-stresses players and allows them to attune and attend to what they need to attend to.
Of course, if they're hearing it for 5 years and they're 25, it has to be different.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Alison, are you there?
Hi there, how are you?
I'm good. So, listen, it's become a bit too depressing and it's become a bit groundhoggish now that there's problems, and that there's problems starting with the players in terms of basic skills. There's structural problems we've heard about. The pipeline isn't working quick enough. The overall volume isn't there. The financial backing isn't there to put an AIL type structure in place. I mean, it's that balance again between finger pointing and personal responsibility. Where do you stand on the reasons behind Ireland's very poor season?
Well, you know, there aren't just one or two reasons. There's a number of issues underneath the surface there. And I think the panel on RTE, Fiona Steed, Jenny Murphy and Lynn Cantwell did very well in trying to analyse that after the game. But I think for me, one of the core issues there is there just isn't the level of club competition that the players need to play at to be able to jump into Test rugby. And I think Lindsay Peat talked about in an interview before the match, which in itself was sort of extraordinary that a player was doing that, and, you know, the IRFU sort of didn't respond to it. But I think she identified that, you know, there are players coming in who have very little club rugby under their belt, so they've just played sevens, and that just isn't really the case in, say, France and England, where the club structure is incredibly strong. And yes, you're not getting test level rugby at your club, but you're getting somewhere, you know, very close to it in the top three or four clubs, certainly in England here. And, you know, if there was one issue you could solve immediately, I think investment in a proper AIL with, you know, money for you know, coaching and resourcing and all the rest of it would go actually quite a long way to solving a problem quickly. But there are other issues, of course, in terms of numbers and pipeline, and it always comes back to cash, doesn't it? And
there
are a few have put a strategy out there for women's rugby, but, you know, not much money behind it. So I think there are lots of issues to solve there.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there is like a hierarchy of nasty problems to solve. But if you had the magic wand now, you'd go for the some sort of competitive week in, week out rugby.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, Ireland has often achieved despite its sort of lack of club structure. So when they were winning Grand Slams and, you know, Six Nations titles, it was kind of on the back of, you know, an AIL which had a decent sort of top four team in the first division, but the standard between one and two was very low, not very many clubs playing, and that's a problem. And so, you know, that can be solved. And yes, there's a bit more exposure around the AIL, but actually when you're watching, you know, teams six versus eight or etc., standard's actually quite poor, I think, for that level. So that's just one issue you could identify, but there are others. And I think the frustration for, you know, somebody who is an Irish fan and who was involved in the IRFU back when it was run as the IWRFU is that they didn't capitalise on success. And you had two title winning teams and, you know, they're now fifth in the Six Nations, beaten by Italy and Wales. You know, that's very frustrating to stand back and watch, I think.
Indeed. And I mean, if you were ruthless about it, you'd say as a sporting spectacle, it's inferior to a lot of other sports, regardless of gender. And it's getting more than the airtime it deserves. So I suppose that kind of proves the case in a while. The reason it's getting the airtime it is because it was successful.
Yeah. And I think Lynn Cantwell's point actually on RT on Sunday was very accurate. And she said it's not easy to actually become a world class team, you know, as an Irish team, because obviously the resources are lower in terms of playing numbers and all the rest of it and investment. And we had a world class Irish team, actually a top four in the world team who beat New Zealand, who won Six Nations Grand Slam. And for that momentum not to be seized upon is incredibly frustrating, because actually they've now fallen quite a way behind. And in anyone who's been reading what I've been writing about how England are surging ahead because of their premiership structure and because of the money in the national team, It's going to be very hard to catch up now in a way that it probably wasn't a couple of years ago. So I think there are, you know, serious issues that need to be addressed there. And I really hope the IRFU are listening.
OK, Alison, but on a slightly more positive level and feeding into what scrumqueens.com covers in terms of the sweet spot that women's rugby finds itself in now in England, there really is a very marketable product there. And you've said it yourself, it's about cash. So it's not as if there shouldn't be willing and able, I suppose, corporate sponsors, albeit we are a country of 5 million or whatever. But there's a bit of packaging to be done, and it's difficult to package what we saw at the weekend.
It's true, but I think, you know, they're not a bad team because they lost to Wales and lost to Italy. They're not as good a team as they were, or certainly not as good a team as they could be. But, you know, rugby is very popular in Ireland. And, you know, women's rugby is able to capitalise on that.
It was last
when they're
week,
doing
anyway.
Well. They haven't quite done that. So all is not lost, for sure. And I think around the world, the women's game is really, you know, it's becoming a sort of a sport which is marketable and which is attracting sort of commercial interest, both from broadcasters, and you can see that by the, you know, the level of interest from broadcaster for the Six Nations this year, and fans. You know, this was a record-breaking Six Nations in terms of crowds, it turned out, including in Ireland. You know, they got 5,000 people to Donnybrook at, you know, 5 o'clock on a Friday. So the product, you know, yes, the quality of rugby hasn't been as good as they would like, but there is a market there. There is a really good product there, and the players are very marketable. You know, you take 17-year-old winger making her, you know, starting debut for Ireland last weekend. I thought she did really well, and there are some other players around her who the team can be built on and who, you know, profiles can be built from in terms of marketing. So, you know, all is certainly not lost, but I think you know, the RFU are going to have to do something a bit different.
Do they care?
My worry is that they won't. They have not listened in the past to players when they've raised issues like this, so I'm unsure as to whether that will start now.
Ali, Michael here, just on that, we went to Philip Brown's presentation there a few months ago, and he said that from his point of view, or the IRFU's point of view, that they don't see any difference between sevens and 15s. Is that going to be detrimental?
I mean, look, the thing about sevens and 15s in the women's game is each country has to kind of cut its cloth to suit, you know, its measure, and every country is doing this slightly differently. But I think the game has headed in a direction in the women's game where sevens and 15s programmes have got to be separated out fully, and the countries who have been successful realised that years ago and went for it. So, you know, your Canada's, your New Zealand's, your Australia's. It's taken England till right now to do that, and they've been immediately successful again in the Six Nations. So, you know, it's up to, you know, he obviously has to look at the evidence in front of him in terms of playing numbers and investment. But I think, you know, you're going to have definitely separate programs. 15s, you know, players who are focusing on 15s games, sevens players who are focusing on sevens, because that sort of crossing over back and forth, it makes neither team successful, and we know that because we've seen that happen to, you know, England are probably the best example, but you know, France too, sort of mixing and matching between sevens and 15s, and one program sort of doing all right and the other program spluttering along. So, you know, that decision is his. He's the chief exec of the union, but I think that actually, if you want the team to be successful, they need to be treated separately as separate entities and separate levels of athletes and separate sort of programs. And at the moment, that's not quite happening in Ireland.
Brilliant, Ali. Thanks. Anything but another review group is how I'll conclude that one. But thanks as ever for joining us on Wednesday. Alison Donnelly of scrumqueens.com. And we'll leave Alison get back to her day job over in London. I know she's busy at the moment. Just going to wrap up, Steve, with you, because like, I really enjoyed the chat, but what, tell us about how you're earning a crust now.
No, yeah, I operate with individual rugby players and athletes going to the Olympic Games and Paralympics Ireland. So private clients in business, sport, and then I lecture as well, which I enjoy greatly. So yeah, keeps me busy.
Yeah.
Finishing the doctorate, whilst it was on mental toughness, was a test of my own mental toughness.
Yeah.
And remembering our days back in Trinity in UCD, I was never the most academic of people. So
you were always a successful man in my eyes.
Dara, I love you more every moment.
It was good talking to you. Wes, anything to add?
I suppose just on that note, we always hear bits and pieces about, you know, psychology or teams mm-hmm. in a good place or not. But I never remember a championship in rugby or in anything dominated by discussions in the media of psychology, confidence, momentum, mood.
Can I come in there? That's because there isn't a traditional relationship between the camp and the media anymore. It seems to have changed, and that's not the camp's fault. It's now a completely different landscape. Players have their own way of expressing through their own channels.
I don't think it was confined to here now, though. I think it was the case in, I think it was the same in Wales. I think it was the same in England, particularly after the weekend.
But
there used to be embedded journalism. There used to be kind of a, and it probably wasn't that ethical either, but there was fellas who would cover up certain stories because they knew other stories were more important. It wasn't covering up any war crimes or anything, but there was a trust that has long gone. And now I think that the IRFU and other bodies have to control the message. They don't have any alternative because the media landscape is so fragmented.
So you think all the psychology talk is just because they have nothing
vacuum.
Else to talk about?
Like we're doing today. But like, I mean, it's not as if we could get Johnny Sexton in here and have a full and frank with him.
We would have
to put in a request for 4 years' time.
I suppose, Steve, do you think, has the game reached some kind of threshold or something where this kind of area is becoming amplified in importance because there is such a level of technical proficiency right across the board? Or I don't know. Is there a reason why it was more prevalent this year than others?
There's a greater talk, prevalence of it, and an understanding or awareness. But as we know, psychology's been there since there was two people walking on earth. And if we look at coaching, Wes, good coaches are good psychologists. Look at we talked about Cody, we look at Eddie O'Sullivan, we look at Kidney. They're master manipulators of people. So it's always been there. I think the key thing is to look at the true values of what you want to attain in those environments. And ironically, counterintuitive to what I'm saying, psychology is common sense. Go out, have a plan, enjoy your plan, look to grow and improve your skills instead of protecting something, and recognize that stress is going to come along. It can be useful, but in a certain level. But psychology's been there since...
Yes, but it's dominated the discussion now.
Yeah.
Isn't that cultural? Because we're all amateur shrinks now.
Well, absolutely, Dar. We all are.
And the vocabulary we use in our day-to-day life now is
It might be
inherited.
Just the latest growth of this kind of pseudo-intellectual alternative rugby media. First it was GIFs on tactical things. Now the hip thing to talk about
is
the psychology of the team.
Well, listen, it's mindset. It can mean anything. I mean, it started with mindset. That was the first buzzword I remember. It's what's the team's mindset.
It was funny
mindset.
When Steve said it there, and like I did a small bit of study in this kind of area myself, and I always did think that really it's common sense.
Yeah, well, the perception that we create within people creates their reality, and we talked about that earlier on, whether it's a growth mindset with young children and not trying to protect their intelligence and seeing that their effort and their attitude is key. It's the same thing in playing sport. We go back to the values of attitude, work rate, and that actually allows us perform better, which is the process you talked about with Cody and all the rest. It's effort and attitude that defines us and not a result.
Lovely way to end it. Okay, a win for the zebras as opposed to the humans is what we're after. This is the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks indeed for checking us out. And I hope you enjoyed at least some of the discussions we had with Steve McIver, who was our guest today. And many thanks to him, with Michael, with Wes, Bryony on sound, Ronan Lawler produced. And don't forget, you can get us anywhere you get your podcasts, RTE.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or any of the similar platforms. Thanks again.